Let's get our view from the middle. He's the columnist for USA Today. See what he's up to in the red section of that particular publication. Online, it's usatoday.com. On Twitter, the handle is at George Schroeder. George, a delightful Wednesday to you, sir. How's life treating you?
Life is good. How are you?
We're doing great. You know, we've often spoken about Oklahoma City, the Thunder, and how while in the state of your residence, you get Sooner fans, Oklahoma State fans, even Longhorn fans, there's a unity when it comes to the NBA franchise, and that's a brutal finish to a brutal series. I know you're wired in to the sports media. So how would you describe the reaction to, I guess, what you would refer to as a devastating ending to a season like that?
Well, stunned, and also a real disappointing season, because I think they thought, a lot of the fans thought, certainly there was a point from December on to the All-Star break where the Thunder played about as well as anybody in the NBA, not named the Warriors, and Paul George was playing at a very MVP level. And then after the All-Star break, they really weren't a very good team. They kind of slumped. And you look at that at Game 5 last night, and it was a terrific game just viewed on its own. But from the Thunder's standpoint, it was kind of a microcosm of the season in a lot of ways. You get down, you know, you're playing well, then you give up a big run, then you go on a big run, then you melt, you let a 15-point lead for 7 minutes melt away. And then, obviously, the dagger by Lillard was, you know, terrific theater, and unless you're a Thunder fan. So, and by the way, I'll note that he opened the series with a logo 3, and he closed the series with a logo 3. What a fantastic performance by him throughout the series, but especially last night.
Yeah, George, are we on some kind of speaker or a device? Because you kind of just went a little tinny. Your sound just changed, like you were doing a sound check for your concert.
Yeah, it is a sound check for my concert. I've just taken you off the Bluetooth.
You're back.
Put you back on. Just I'm putting the phone back up to my ear. It's just that sometimes I think the phone quality is a little bit iffy when you put it up to your ear, and I just don't have my wired headphones.
Okay,
you sound like
you're sitting next to me now, so it's perfect.
Oh, perfect. Well, that's good, because I only wish I were sitting next to you.
All right.
I was sitting next to Oregon Athletic Director Rob Mullins here recently. Here at the College Football Playoffs annual spring meeting, we were just sort of sitting down and chatting, and of course he's in as the head of the chair of the selection committee.
Oh, right. You know, when somehow for me, I'm like, I always talk about my own personal hard drive, so when the college football season in the rear view, I delete a few things to add some college basketball and MLB and golf. So I'll catch up eventually, George. But
no problem. But no, it's just good to have him. Just a good. There's nothing substantive to tell you.
He just totally cut out there,
George.
Yeah, George just completely cut out there. It almost felt like there was, I don't know, some kind of a wind-aided issue that kind of knocked him off the air. So we're efforting to get Mr. Schroeder back. We will do our best. All right. By the way, you could always text us, regardless of if we're in the middle of an interview or whatever the circumstance might be, 321-0824. I will say that Nick just got his first congratulations on the Sharks text, and that itself was an entity unto its own for comebacks. All right, George Schroeder once again rejoins us. George, make sure you're there this time.
I'm here.
Okay. So back to OKC. Obviously, they suffered a blow when Durant left for Golden State. They got Paul George in a trade involving Victor Oladipo. Then they signed him, but now three straight first-round exits. And I get he's under contract for next year, and it's the emotional aftermath. Any kind of buzz or talk surrounding, I guess, the job stability of Billy Donovan?
Well, absolutely, and even some talk about Sam Presti, who's kind of their, been their whiz-bang general manager out of the Spurs organization for these 10 years. There's even some talk about him too, but I don't think it's anything more than talk about either one of them. It's certainly possible that Billy Donovan could be let go. If that's going to happen, it'll happen in the next few days, I think. But, you know, it's also possible they don't do much of anything in terms of change, and they sort of ride with what they've got. They're going to have to try to figure out some more better shooters from the wing.
Yep.
To try to help out what they've got. But I think the larger question about this team is, you know, Russell Westbrook is who Russell Westbrook is, and if we can get away from sort of his post game lack, and bad Russ. And my question is, can you find a way to funnel him into being good Russ more of the time than bad Russ? I'm not even sure that bad Russ is a terribly bad thing. It's just it's not a championship level type of guy. So I think there are all sorts of questions about sort of the Thunder way as they head to this offseason. I don't think that it means changes in coaching staff, but it absolutely could. I could. You know.
We're talking with George Schroeder of USA Today. So you attended the Georgia spring game this past weekend. I could tell you I was at the Oregon game on press row with a laptop. You had a slightly more unique experience. For folks that hadn't heard, what was your vantage point for the event the Bulldogs refer to as G-Day?
I was in that locked room known as the instant replay review booth. And I got to try my hand as being the replay official for the game, which is pretty cool. It's the third year in a row that the SEC has had at one of their spring games a crew of media officials. I got to do it last year at the South Carolina spring game. I was a back judge down there on the field in the vertical zebra stripes. But this year they did that, and they added a replay official component to it. They don't really do replay in those games in terms of reviewing them like you
right.
do. But they asked if I would do that, and it was really kind of a pretty cool experience. I mean, I'll just tell you this: replay has advanced in terms of obviously the technology, but even the protocols and the procedures that you go through on every single play have advanced about 100,000 light years since its infancy. For example, back in that the 2006 when the Oklahoma Oregon thing happened, that kind of thing wouldn't happen today because they're so much better at doing what they do. And I'm not trying to get into that old argument. I'm just saying that there's better technology, and they've got a better set of parameters. I mean, it's greatly expanded what they can actually review. They've got a whole lot more angles. It's a better setup than it used to be.
You know, you mentioned South Carolina last year. You played back judge, and I'm sure if you asked folks what they'd like to try or which job is more difficult or testing, you'd get a variety of answers. So now that you've done both, be it the pressure to make a timely call or keep up with the speed of the game, how contrasting was it to be upstairs in the booth, downstairs with an official's jersey on?
Yeah, so I found the official's jersey thing to be terrifying and exhilarating at the same time. And I, by contrast, this one wasn't quite as nerve-wracking to be up in the replay booth. On the other hand, we didn't end up with like some kind of a dire situation where like a controversial play, was he inbounds or out, or is this targeting or not? And I can see where that could become a problem, especially if you buzz down to stop play and now you're feeling the clock ticking in the back of your head as you're trying to make the right decision. But I actually think that it's not that I would ever call the replay official thing easy. It is not. Those guys know a ton of football, way more than I'll ever know, and they do a lot better work in an efficient manner than I was ever able to. But I think probably the back judge thing is a more difficult deal.
Yeah, you mentioned the Oklahoma game, and of course, for Duck and Sooner fans, that's for eternity. I think of the pass interference against Glenn Sharp when Ohio State beat Miami in 2002.
Right.
I know Don Dankinger. So, you know, you can go on and on.
They still can't review the pass interference, and in college football, that's probably not going to change. I realize that's a new thing with the NFL, but that call would have stood even
right.
even if it was a bad call, and I'm not necessarily sure. But that call would never have been overturned, even with replay.
Yeah.
In college football.
And, you know, you, the way you approach your job, you've never been what I would call a basher-style journalist. But from doing that, and I think a lot of fans and even media lose sight because one bad call and all of a sudden it's a total disaster. The refs are the worst.
Right.
How much appreciation do you have for the job they do and the crazy high percentage they get right?
Yeah, no, that's the thing. And I think I had a lot of respect for officials before I went through this last two spring games, you know, back judge and then replay official. But I definitely, I've now, it's not even just doing the job. It's the time you spend with two different now SEC officiating crews on the Friday before those games where they sort of teach you sort of what you're going to do, just the bare basics of what you're going to do. And you get to know them a little bit. And you also go through sort of a kind of a instructional training course from Steve Shaw, who's the SEC's coordinator of officials. He's also the rules secretary of the NCAA's Football Rules Committee. You go through kind of a, you know, here's sort of our, the what we expect of our officials. And they come away, on the one hand, understanding both from the stuff they teach you and the experience you go through trying to do their jobs, understanding just how competent, not incompetent, but how competent they are and how much they have to account for on every single play. And on the other hand, just how much integrity they have. They're not out to get your team or favoring their team or whatever. Just because they live in, you know, Birmingham doesn't mean they're an Alabama fan or an Auburn fan, right? Just because they live in Seattle doesn't make them a Huskies fan. So I have way more respect for them than I ever had, and I think I had a ton of respect before. They are, by and large, and this is not just an SEC thing, very competent and have a ton of integrity. And I realize that everybody wants to say, oh, but the Pac-12 refs when I'm on a Eugene radio station. I hear you. You know what? That's what they would, if I was on an Oklahoma City radio station, they'd say, oh, but the Big 12 refs.
Right.
Oh, but the Big 10 refs. Let me just say this. There's a ton of really, 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 really good officials doing really, really good work on 98% of the plays, and we see some of the mistakes, and then we decide they're all, you know, motivated wrongly or they're incompetent at all times, and I think that's largely incorrect.
And completely out to get us.
Of course, yes, they are all out to get the Ducks, for sure.
Beavers. A couple final thoughts for George Schroeder. So, rules changes this season. Stronger targeting rules. They'll review calls to confirm elements of targeting, see if they were present. If not, the call won't stand. Is it logical to think this is just a common sense next step? And because the penalty is ejection and maybe missing half the next game, it's just vital to verify they got it right?
Yeah, no, I think, and that's exactly what it does. Those marginal targeting calls will go away. Now, Steve Shaw said that again, the SEC's coordinator of officials and he's the rules secretary for the rule committee, said, or secretary rules editor is the weird title. He said that their data showed that only 10% of calls that were, you know, they're all reviewed, all the targeting calls are reviewed, only 10% were then determined to stand. They were all either confirmed or overturned, the other 90%. So, and of course, to confirm something or to overturn something, you have to have, quote, indisputable video evidence. So, to stand is whatever the call was, I can't overturn it or I can't confirm it because I don't quite have the evidence. So in this case, approximately 10% of the targeting calls from last year would be overturned because you could not confirm them. I actually think it's a really good rule to do that. And, you know, every other instance of replay, there's confirmed, stands, or overturned. In this case, it's just confirmed or overturned. And I think given the penalty, the harsh penalty that you get in terms of getting ejected, and sometimes you're ejected for the next, you know, the first half of the next game,
right?
If this happens in the second half, I think that's appropriate. And hopefully it will lead to fewer people getting those marginal calls popped on them.
And lastly, let's call it the Texas A&M versus LSU rule, the 7 overtime game last year. So now they say if a fourth overtime is done, it's tied. It's almost like a one-time soccer shootout. They go right to two-point conversions. Then they give two-minute rests after the second and fourth overtime. You know, because there have only been five overtime games the past 5 years, you know, is this just a matter of it makes sense and is more preventative because people were really concerned about the safety of the players after last year's marathon?
Yeah, look, it's such a one-off of an event that it's not something that you want to overhaul the overtime rules for. But it's also a situation where how do you address it if and when it does go there? And I think going to two-point plays after a certain point makes a ton of sense. And what it does is it cuts down, it doesn't change the actual nature of overtime, but it cuts down on the sheer number of plays that those players are having to play. If you watch that game, and almost all of us did, I think, because it, the way it sort of was such a late game, yep, and just kept going and going and going, so most of us, or many of us, probably caught on sometime during the overtime sessions, you recognize that by the end, those kids were gassed. This will cut down on the number of plays, you know, and yet it was a pretty good compromise in that it doesn't change the character of college overtime, which I happen to think is a great, the actual format of college football overtime is a great format. And then, you know, you hear people talking about, well, let's move it back to the 40 instead of starting at the 25. Well, that actually is just going to create more plays in those weird long overtime, you know, multiple overtime settings. So I actually think going to two-point plays after however many overtimes it is a great idea.
I thought the both rules incorporated common sense, logic, and they enhanced the game. And I don't ask for much more than that. folks, he's George Schroeder of USA Today on Twitter, at George Schroeder. George, always a pleasure. Great stuff. And we shall chat again in a week.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
All right. Take it easy.